I want you to imagine a time, or maybe remember a time, when something bad happened, when you were in a terrible situation. Maybe you'd been wronged. Maybe you'd experienced some kind of insult or personal attack. How did you feel? Or imagine how you might feel. How did you react? What were the emotions welling up? How did you pray? Were you able to pray? I remember a time quite vividly when I was a child. I was about 7 years old or something like that. I was in the playground at school running, and I was running along, and I was looking, for some reason, I was looking over there, maybe at a ball or at someone else or something. And suddenly I got this blow to my head, and it was really painful. And I was kind of reeling from this blow to my head. And as I was kind of in pain, I thought, someone has run into me. And I just remember this anger kind of welling up. And I think I came up from this kind of, ow, I've hurt my head, with my fist ready. And as I turned round, I saw this wall, and I'd run into a wall. So there was a classroom that kind of came out, and I'd run into a wall. And of course, my anger just kind of evaporated because it was pretty clear that the wall couldn't be blamed for what had just happened. But I remember this anger that just welled up. And clearly, if it had been someone else, it was also my fault. But that was my reaction to what had happened there. David here has been wronged by a number of people. He's also suffering the consequences of his sin, as we've thought and as we'll see. His life is a mess in some ways. Let's look together at what happened, and let's look more importantly at what God is doing here. So we pick up this story after a battle. It's the battle between the men of David and the men of Absalom. Absalom was David's son rebelling against David. Absalom was killed, his followers have been scattered, and now it's time to send a message to David to tell him. I've divided this passage into two sections. The first section I've called God Delivers, Even Amid the Sad Consequences of Sin. It's a nice snappy title, sorry about that. God Delivers, Even Amid the Sad Consequences of Sin. And as we pick up this passage, we have this man, Ahimaaz. You may remember him. He was one of the ones who hid in the well and then took the news to David when David was running away from Jerusalem. Now it seems he's taken part in this battle. And he says, verse 19, "Let me run and take the news to the king that the Lord has vindicated him by delivering him from the hand of his enemies." He wants to run. Joab says no. Joab, I think, didn't want Ahimaaz to be associated with the bad news of Absalom's death. So verse 21, he sends someone else, this Cushite, and off runs the Cushite. But Ahimaaz doesn't leave it there. He's eager to run. He keeps pressing Joab to be allowed to run. And Joab in the end gives in, lets him run. Why does Ahimaaz want to run? Well, we're not told, but it's possible that he's eager for a reward. Good news might bring a reward with it. It's also possible that he wants to be the one who gives David the good news that God has delivered him from his enemies, and he wants to be the one to deliver that and thinks he can deliver that in the best way. Anyway, off he goes. And then verse 24, we meet David again, so the scene moves over to David. He's in a place called Mahanaim where he was based, and he's waiting for the news. And the narrative slows right down, and it's almost frustrating, isn't it? David is sitting there, there's the man on the wall, and he's calling down, and he sees the man and the man, and then he sees another man, and you're kind of thinking, I want to get to the point where David hears the news, and how is he going to react? The last thing he said to his commanders was, "Be gentle with Absalom," and he's about to hear this news. He's sitting by the gate. It's almost a little bit reminiscent of Eli sitting waiting for the news of what had happened to the Ark of the Covenant. Remember, we're still in the book of Samuel, even if that was in 1 Samuel. I think that's no accident. Here he is, waiting for news and fearing and probably knowing that what he fears will come true. Here comes Ahimaaz, verse 28. He gets there and he says, "All is well, good news, good news. God has delivered up those who lifted their hands against my lord the king." And then he doesn't mention Absalom. Even when David presses him, He doesn't mention it. It's at the least deceptive. At worst, it's an outright lie, isn't it? He clearly knows about Absalom, but he doesn't tell David. That only delays the inevitable moment we're waiting for of David hearing the bad news. And that's verse 31. The Cushite arrives and he tells the news. David, verse 33, is shaken and he goes into mourning straight away. You can see his deep grief here. And he says, look at his words, if only I had died instead of you. If only I had died instead of you. I think those are not empty words. Remember, David is genuinely guilty here. He committed adultery with Bathsheba. If that hadn't happened, if he hadn't done that, none of this would have happened. Absalom, in a way, has died as a direct consequence of that. And I think there's a sense in which David is recognizing God's judgment and recognizing that that judgment should have fallen on David instead. And implicitly, he's recognizing God's mercy there to him. And we've seen a lot of things happen since chapter 11, haven't we? We're now in chapter 18 and chapter 19. Since that fateful night when David committed adultery with Bathsheba. And what we're seeing is we're seeing that sin has consequences. You see, in the moment of temptation, we can believe the lie that sin has no consequences. But that is not true. That is not true. These words, these events, these chapters are written to warn us of the danger of sin and the terrible consequences of sin. Sin has consequences in this life, and sin has consequences in eternity. Because one day we're all going to face a holy God who judges sin. As we move into chapter 19, the troops come back from the battle and Joab comes back with them. And they're, instead of what's expected, which is celebrating a victory, like a 6-1 victory, they don't get that celebration they're expecting. What do they get? The king is mourning and grieving. And they come into the town as if they're ashamed, as if they've been defeated. And Joab, what does Joab do? Joab, verse 5, goes and rebukes David pretty sharply. He says, look, the men who saved you are being humiliated. Look at what Joab says. He says, the men who've just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters. Of course, Joab conveniently neglects to mention one of David's sons, Absalom, which for whose death Joab was pretty responsible. But he's effectively saying, look, David, you need to go and show your appreciation for all these men who fought for you. In other words, you need to get on with going and being king, David. And we can sort of see their points of view, I think, both of them. David has just lost his son. Of course he's grieving. Of course he's mourning. And it's hard to imagine any situation where it would be right to celebrate the death of your son. And on the other hand, there's Joab. Well, of course Joab cares that these men have risked their lives for David. And he cares that they're honored. And what he says in verse 6 is he says, look, this is a message you're sending, David. You're sending the message that you love those who hate you and you hate those who love you. In verse 7, he's even more strong. It says, look, these men are going to leave you if you're not careful. David's kingship is in danger, according to Joab. What's going on here? Well, this is a mess, isn't it? This is a real mess. The son of the Lord's anointed king is dead. He's dead at the hands of the king's own men who've won a victory over an armed rebellion against the king. This is a mess. This is the sin, the hurricane of sin, which has left destruction in its wake. None of this should ever have happened. We shouldn't be in this situation. Joab here, well, he's kind of saved David's kingdom in a way, hasn't he? He's killed Absalom, he's removed the threat, and here he's kind of helping David to go out and save the morale of his men. But on the other hand, he's disobeyed David. And he's shown pretty disrespectful attitude towards the king, hasn't he? There's no kind of your majesties and your servants, which everyone else is scattering their speech with in this chapter. Joab kind of pretty directly goes and rebukes David. And David, well, he's kind of wallowing in this grief and almost despair, isn't he? What's going on here? How are we to read this? The author doesn't give us a judgment on these characters at this time. I think what we're supposed to see is what God is doing, that God is in control. God is sovereign. God is causing these events to happen in order to restore David to his throne. You see, Ahimaaz gets the point in verse 19 of chapter 18. He says, "Let me run and take the news to the king that the Lord has vindicated him by delivering him from the hand of his enemies." And the Cushite, look what he says in verse 31. "My lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has vindicated you today by delivering you from the hand of all who rose up against you." They get what's going on. God is at work. See, Ahimaaz, he's deceptive. Joab is disobedient, pretty disrespectful. David, he's wallowing in his grief and in his regret. But in the midst of that, God is at work, putting his king back on the throne. And we live in a mess too, don't we? So often we live in the midst of the consequences of our own sin and the consequences of the sin of other people. And there are people who've wronged us and people we've wronged. And we're all kind of swimming in this sea of that. And sometimes it can feel pretty difficult and pretty terrible. But God is working deliverance. God is bringing about his salvation plan. We need to remember that. We need to let our lives be shaped by it. God delivers, even amid the sad consequences of sin. That's the first point. We're going to move on and look at chapter 19, verse 9 through to 40. I've called this, "God's King is full of forgiveness and mercy." Okay, God's King is full of forgiveness and mercy. And here the scene moves away from Mahanaim and David, and it moves back to Israel. Remember, the people of Israel, most of whom had supported Absalom, they fought this battle. Absalom's been killed, and they've all run away and gone back home. And now they're in a pickle. Okay, they're in a pickle because they've rejected David as king, and yet Absalom, who they'd anointed, is dead. And there's a telling kind of note, or just a telling word here, I think, as you look at what they say to each other in verse 10. "Absalom, whom we anointed to rule over us, has died in battle." Absalom, who anointed him? They anointed him. Not God. He wasn't God's anointed king. This is an echo of what we've seen in the days of Saul and the days of Samuel. Here are the people. What have they done? They've rejected God's anointed king, and they've taken Absalom. Good-looking Absalom, impressive Absalom. He'll be our king. We anointed him. God looks at the heart, and man looks at the outward appearance, and the people still don't get it. There's an echo of that. And now they're in this pickle because they can sort of expect David's wrath against them because they've rebelled against him. And yet also they kind of want him back, and maybe they want him back for the wrong reasons, but what's going to happen? What are they going to do? What is David going to do? And what David does is he wins back their hearts by showing them mercy. Remember, Absalom had stolen the hearts of the people. David wins their hearts back by showing them mercy. And this is what characterizes this section as David returns to Jerusalem. Mercy, his mercy is what we see. So what does he do? Verse 11, he sends a message to Judah. And he shows mercy to Judah. Remember, Absalom was crowned in Hebron back in chapter 15. That was where he chose to go. That was where his supporters were in Judah. So they can perhaps expect reprisals from David. But verse 12, David doesn't say that. He doesn't say, "I've got my eye on you after what you did in Hebron." No, he says, "You don't have anything to fear. You're my own flesh and blood." Verse 13, he shows mercy to Amasa. Amasa was the commander of Absalom's army. Okay, so you might expect him to kind of make an example of Amasa. But he doesn't. He shows mercy to him. And kind of by inference, he extends that mercy to everyone who fought under Amasa. And he says he's going to make Amasa the commander of his army in place of Joab. We don't We don't know why. Maybe it's because of what Joab's been doing in the previous chapters that David's not very happy with. It's just a kind of side note, isn't it, the author gives us. The point is, David is showing mercy to Judah here. And verse 14, it works. He wins over their hearts. And they all come down to the Jordan to meet him. So there's this large delegation. Verse 15, he goes as far as the Jordan, and then all these people come, and most of them are men of Judah, but there's also 1,000 Benjamites, which is interesting, isn't it? And the episodes that follow mirror the episodes that we saw when David left Jerusalem. So if you remember, as David fled from Jerusalem, there were these kind of episodes that happened to him and people that he met. So it's as if there's these episodes as he leaves. And now there's these episodes that mirror them as he comes back. It's showing us that God is at work. He's kind of thrown David out, and now he's restoring David to his throne. It's highlighting that God is restoring David. So let's look at these episodes. First one, we have Shimei, verse 18 down to 23. You'll remember Shimei from chapter 16. He was the man who was throwing mud at David and cursing him. And Abishai said, let's cut off his head. And David said, no, we're not going to do that. He said, I'm in God's hands, effectively. And he said, maybe God has told Shimei to curse me. He's very aware that he's in God's hands. Anyway, here comes Shimei in our chapter. And he falls on the ground and confesses his sin to David in verse 20. And Abishai, good old Abishai, verse 21, tries again. Let's kill him. Let's chop his head off this time. And he's got a point. I mean, he's got a point, hasn't he? He's right. This man has cursed the Lord's anointed. Remember in what high honor David held the Lord's anointed when Abishai was trying to pin Saul to the ground with that spear. David said, no, he's the Lord's anointed. Maybe Abishai is thinking back to that and thinking, oh, we should honor the Lord's anointed. Let's kill him. And David says, no, we're not going to do that. Not today, anyway. In verse 23, he says, you're not going to die. You're not going to die. David overlooks Shimei's offense. So he's not saying Shimei hasn't done anything wrong, but he's saying he's going to overlook Shimei's offense. David has been shown mercy by God. He wasn't punished for his sin with Bathsheba, even though we see these consequences. He wasn't punished. Nathan said in chapter 12, you will not die. The Lord has taken away your sin. David has seen mercy from God, and now he echoes that mercy in his dealing with Shimei. What about us? Do we overlook offenses against us? I think probably a personal attack or some very personal criticism that is maybe not just is really hard, isn't it? It's really hard to overlook something like that. This was a very personal attack against David. How do you feel when your children say something to you that's pretty unkind? How dare you say that to me? How dare you treat me like that? Have you said those words or at least thought those words? And of course we need to discipline our children, but in that moment, are we concerned about the discipline of the child, or are we concerned about our own dignity, about our own pride? Maybe our children need to see us overlook an offense. David here, he did overlook a personal attack. He could do that, I think, because he knew he was in the hands of a merciful God, and that was what enabled him to show mercy. We need to remember, don't we, that we're in the hands of a merciful God as we interact with other people, people who hurt us, people we've hurt, people who will hurt us again. This is the world we live in. And the second episode is Mephibosheth. Remember Mephibosheth? He is Jonathan's son. That, of course, makes him Saul's grandson. Kind of prime target for a purge. And yet, David showed him mercy. Back in chapter 16, Ziba, who was Mephibosheth's servant, turned up and told everyone that Mephibosheth had betrayed David. But here there's a twist, because Mephibosheth shows up, and he doesn't look like someone who's a pretender to the king, to pretender to the throne. He looks like someone who's been in mourning. Verse 24, the author tells us he's not been taking care of himself in terms of personal hygiene ever since David left Jerusalem. Okay, that's not one of the characters reporting that. That's the author telling us this is fact. This is what he did. And verse 26 and 27, Mephibosheth comes and kind of presents his case and says, you know, I'm innocent. I've been wrong. But then he throws himself on David's mercy. Look at verse 28. All my grandfathers, that's Saul's, all Saul's descendants deserve nothing but death from my lord the king. But you gave your servant a place among those who eat at your table. So what right do I have to make any more appeals to the king? He recognizes he deserves nothing from David. He throws himself on David's mercy. And that's just like us facing the returning king, Jesus. We need to throw ourselves on God's mercy, don't we? We don't have any basis for appeal, just like Mephibosheth. We don't deserve anything from his hand. And David is kind of in a tricky situation now because Ziba kind of helped him out. And Mephibosheth is saying he's been betrayed by Ziba, and how's he going to deal with that? So David says, well, just 50-50, you can have half each of the stuff. And it almost looks lazy, doesn't it, on David's part, where he's just kind of, I can't be bothered to think about this, just divide it between you. And I wonder if, I'm not sure it is laziness, I wonder if it's partly a test. You know, what's Mephibosheth going to do? Or at least we can see it as a test. How is Mephibosheth going to react? Is he going to say, no, I want 75%? Or is he going to say, no, what are you doing? Ziba deserves to be punished. But what does he do in verse 30? What does he do? He takes delight in God's king. I'm going to read you some words from 1 Samuel chapter 18. And I'll tell you why in a minute. This is 1 Samuel chapter 18. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Verse 30 of our passage, Mephibosheth said to the king, let him take everything. Now that my lord the king has returned home safely. Here is a true son of Jonathan. He's acting like the son of Jonathan, isn't he? He's lame, but he's devoted to his king. He says Ziba can have it all because Mephibosheth has David back. It reminds me of that song that we sing, take the world, but give me Jesus. Take the world, but give me Jesus. I thought of that too late, so that's why it's not in there. The list of songs, but it's a good song. The point is, we need to prioritize our stuff. No, we don't. We need to prioritize Jesus over our stuff, don't we? Because it's better to be a lame devotee of the king than the guy who walks away with all the stuff. Okay, not that we need to get rid of all our material possessions and become some kind of hermit. That's not what I'm saying. But what matters to you most? What matters to you most? What would you do if you had that choice? I remember a time as a student when I was walking around in town and I saw a Porsche, and I was in a kind of, I suppose, a group of friends who would have kind of looked at that and said, okay, that's why we're here. That's why we're here at uni, because that is the kind of car I want to drive. And I remember looking at it and thinking, well, if I'm going to take Jesus seriously, am I going to drive this kind of car? I don't know. Now, I'm not saying that Christians can't drive Porsches, but I suppose I'm saying it's unlikely that if I take Jesus seriously, I'm going to end up driving a Porsche. What matters most? For Mephibosheth, what mattered most was David. We need to be devoted to God's king, to King Jesus, above everything else. And that's what we learn from Mephibosheth. And then comes the next episode, which is this man, Barzillai. Now, you may remember him. He was back in chapter 17. He turned up when David had run away from Jerusalem and was in Mahanaim. He turned up with loads of stuff, loads of food and bedding and things, and helped David out. And verse 32 of our chapter kind of suggests that actually that wasn't just a one-off gift, that he was constantly providing for David and maybe all his men as well when they were in Mahanaim. He was clearly a very wealthy man. He had a lot of stuff. What did he do with his stuff? Well, Mephibosheth showed his devotion to the king by letting Ziba take all the stuff. Barzillai showed his devotion to God's king by using his stuff to honor the king. Verse 31, Barzillai has come down Why is he there? He obviously isn't there to cry for mercy. He's there to send David on his way. I don't think he's looking for a reward. I think he wants to honor David. Perhaps he wants to set eyes on David for the last time before he dies. In verse 33, what does David do? What does David say to Barzillai? So we've just had verse 32. Barzillai has provided for David. And now David says, come with me and I'll provide for you. He wants to kind of repay Barzillai. He doesn't want to let this debt to Barzillai remain outstanding. He's determined to honor his faithful servant. But Barzillai, we have this kind of long speech in verse 34 to 37. He refuses. And he gives this speech about how he's really old and you know, he can't really appreciate things, which is, I suppose, what old people like to do. But he refuses David's offer, but he doesn't reject it. He doesn't reject it. He's not seeking his own glory or his own power, but he says, verse 37, here is your servant Kimham, presumably his son. Let him cross over with my lord the king. And this is kind of odd for this guy, Kimham, who just has basically a walk-on part in the Bible, and no lines, I don't think. What happens here is the author tells us three times that Kimham went with David. Okay, so verse 37, here is Kimham, let him cross over with my lord the king. Okay, that's one. Verse 38, the king says, okay, Kimham shall cross over with me. That's number two. And then verse 40, when the king crossed over, Kimham crossed with him. Number three. So why is this guy, who is kind of a nobody in Bible terms, why is the author so keen for us to know that he crossed the river at this particular point in time? Why is that important? I think what he's showing us is that David is determined to honor and bless his servants. God's king is faithful to bless his servants. So whilst David is ready to overlook an offense, he's not going to overlook a blessing that he's due to give, or a promise, if you like, that he wants to give. He's not going to overlook that. There's no way he's going to overlook that. He takes Kimham with him, so that can be paid, that blessing can be given. And that, of course, is what King Jesus is like, isn't it? He will deliver on his promised blessings, be they blessings of salvation, blessings of an eternity in heaven with him. He will not overlook what he's promised. We can be confident of these things. The words of Jesus himself in Luke 18, no one who has left home or wife or brothers or parents or children for the sake of the kingdom of God will fail to receive many times as much in this age and in the age to come, eternal life. God's king is full of forgiveness and mercy. And we could have added full of blessing. So where are we in all this? Where are we in all this? David wandering around and Ahimaaz telling lies and Joab rebuking people and this man Barzillai who doesn't mean a lot to us. Where are we in all this? Well, we're in a mess, aren't we? We're just like Ahimaaz and Joab and David. We may be following God, but often we're enmeshed in the consequences of our sin and the sin of other people. Maybe we've been wronged by others. Maybe we're suffering. And yet we live in that world, this world, which is waiting and groaning for the return of the king. And we're also the ones who've rebelled. We can also identify, can't we, with those Israelites in verse 19 who are saying, okay, David's gone. We anointed someone else in the place of God's king. Our sin has consequences because one day we will face the returning king. And how will we respond to the return of the king? Well, we need to throw ourselves on God's mercy. Like Shimei, like Mephibosheth, we have no grounds for appeal. We need to throw ourselves on God's mercy because one day Jesus will come back. The only option is to go to him now, if you like, to go to the Jordan and meet him, if you want to extend that allegory beyond where we probably ought to be extending it. But we need to go to Jesus, don't we? And cry to him for mercy and throw ourselves on his mercy. He is merciful. I think it's really interesting that Shimei went. Just think about that. What would you do if you were Shimei? Well, I'd be running in the other direction. I wouldn't be there to meet David, especially not because he's probably going to have Abishai with him with his blade ever ready. I'd have run in the other direction. Except Shimei doesn't. Why not? I think he knows. He knows where mercy can be found. Mercy is found in God's King. Mercy is found in Jesus. Listen to Romans 5, verse 8. God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Let's pray together.